Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're here with Dr. Jeremy Suri, who's professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. His latest book is Liberty's Surest Guardian, American Nation Building from the Founders to Obama. Number here is 410-319-8888. And Jeremy, welcome. Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's one of the most interesting things I read about you last night. I don't know what time it was that I read it, but I read it. Was it your... You're Hindu and Jewish. I mean, you're familiarly.
That's correct.
That's an interesting combination.
It is. It's the American dream, Mark. I mean, my parents are immigrants from two different parts of the world who met in New York City. And
here you are.
And here I am. And I get full standing because my mother's Jewish and my father is Hindu. And so I get full standing in both religions. It's great, isn't it?
It's true. So the idea is that you – and I was reading Liberty's Surest Guardian and reading some of the things you've been writing in the past. And I was really interested, and I really curious to probe this a bit. Your idea of nation building, You think that it is part of the American political persona, that it's been part of the military ethic of America since the beginning, is part of your argument.
Absolutely right. I think it's impossible for us to unthink it because we are founded as a nation building experiment ourselves, and in our own eyes, it's worked pretty well, and so we assume that's the way all societies should operate.
But some of the examples, let's just take an example right now. You've talked about in other places, Afghanistan.
Sure.
And everybody's talking about what to do in Afghanistan.
Right.
That nation building in Afghanistan, for the most part, if you look at it in the moment, in this linear way, is a failure.
Right.
That it's not happening.
Right.
That it can't happen, many would argue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That may be what the Americans want for whatever reason the American government wants it, but it's is it reality?
I think there's a good argument to be made for that. I think what's really interesting is how difficult it was for Americans to come to that realization. What you're saying is not rocket science. It's a very smart insight, Mark, but it's not rocket science. But Americans have a desire in places that are failed states that produce violence to build nation states there because we believe that's a source of stability. And maybe it is, even if it's impossible to do.
But when we look at the history of this country, and folks, you can join us here. We're live, 410-319-8888. You use examples in your book. And as I said, I kind of poured through it, so I don't have it every detail that you wrote about in my head. But you talk about, let's say, the Reconstruction.
Yes.
Or the Philippines.
Right.
And Reconstruction, you say, is one of the first efforts in America at nation building, post-Civil War.
Correct. I think it's one of the most significant efforts of nation building because it's a case where the Union, after its victory, basically imposes its way of life on the South. It doesn't completely work, but that's what creates the end of slavery. It's the largest redistribution of property anywhere in the world in the 19th century, turning slaves into freed people. It was the right thing to do, and we look back on it and say, of course, it should have been done, but it was not an easy thing to do.
But when you look at – let's take some of these examples you use, like Reconstruction. Reconstruction was a failure in that, and because I think that the political powers in America, from Andrew Johnson, the president who was forced to do it, through those down to Rutherford B. Hayes, who didn't have a chance to do anything because he was killed. He may have changed things had he remained president. It was a failure because the powers to be wanted to reinstitute the power that existed before in the South. It was reinstituted.
Yep.
It fit more into the economic future of America, but it was reconstituted. And it did. So it was crushed.
Well, that's part of the story. And so what you might say is, like with every nation-building project, there was an insurgency and there was resistance. The Ku Klux Klan was a kind of insurgency. Jim Crow was an insurgent response. And certainly along racial and civil rights lines, and even along a lot of class and economic lines, absolutely, there isn't the kind of redistribution. Or what's redistributed in 1869 gets sent back in the late 1870s and early 1880s. But other things change significantly. The institutions change. Slavery is gone. And you can't create slavery again. The Union economic model is created. It's an industrial society. It's the Whig vision that takes over in the South. And third, African Americans are given some space to begin to form. And that's the heroic story, right? African Americans seizing their own history. And people like Booker T. Washington and others making a future for them. So it fails more than it succeeds, but it still changes what was there. And it creates a union that we can really call a union. There were two visions of nationhood, Confederate and Union.
Right.
Then there's only one. There's resistance to that. But there ain't no other game in town other than the Union Vision after that.
But the question I have, I suppose, I was reading some of the things in the book, let's say about the Philippines and about where we are today, about what we did in Cuba and the Philippines. What we may look in the world of realpolitik of America as nation building is oppression in somebody else's book.
Yeah.
I mean, you talk about the Philippines. We killed tens of thousands of people in the Philippines.
Yeah.
We brought a revolutionary leader over from China to help throw out the Spaniards and then went after him. And we slaughtered Filipinos so we could have a gateway to China and a gateway to Asia that we could control as a mercantile nation.
I don't disagree with any of that. In fact, and as you know, I talk about a fair amount of that in the book. My argument is that nation building is self-interest on our part. It's not some altruistic idealism at all.
Right.
We should recognize that that's what we've been doing. Let's call it what it is. Let's see it as that. And let's recognize that that's what we're getting into when we do it somewhere else. And let's not pretend it's going to be all about people voting and people being very happy about our being there. That's not always the case. The world of geopolitics is a dirty, difficult world, and we should restrain ourselves, but there also are times when we need to get involved in this.
So how do you see that in the context of the world that we're in now?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, whether it's looking at all of our foreign policy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I know that – well, let me just take a step back for a second. I was going in a different direction. Part of what you argued, seems, is that our – that the international politics, the politics of any nation state, can also be affected by things that go on below it.
Right.
In ways that you don't figure.
Right.
Whether it's how the Arab Spring
exactly.
may affect politics or how Occupy movement in America may affect our geopolitical world.
Absolutely. I think that's crucially important because, as I argue in the book, nation building is a process and it's about many different inputs. And I think that's where we all as citizens need to recognize that we have to be inputs in the process. I have a great deal of respect for the Occupy movement because I think the Occupy movement is raising crucial questions about the kinds of nations we want to build abroad and at home and who we think should be the beneficiaries, who do we think should actually control the decisions. And so that's a definite important part of the process. And one of the things I'm trying to show in my book, Mark, is that's always been the case. We have this image of the United States when it gets involved in foreign policy being all united and everyone marching lockstep. That's never been the case. World War II is the partial exception. Every war has been heavily debated, and not just whether to go to war. As you know, in the Philippines chapter, I show that William Howard Taft, who's put in charge of the civilian administration of the Philippines, actually was against the war.
Right.
But then he says, now we've gone to war, now that we're there.
Great Henry James and lots of other people. Mark Twain.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So those debates are crucial, and I hope we can inspire and give confidence to people, especially young people, to be part of those debates.
We're here with Dr. Jeremy Suri, who is in town to the lecture series at the University of Baltimore around post-2011 and where American policy is going, which we'll talk a bit about as well. He's an interesting thinker, I must confess. I hadn't read his work until we knew he was coming, but he's worth the read. His latest book is Liberty's Surest Guardian, American Nation, Building from the Founders to Obama. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And if your guests want to hear a little bit, you can share some headphones. And let's go to Mike. In Baltimore. Mike, you're on the air.
Good evening, folks.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Good as I can be, like the rest of us. Here's the deal. I think the founding of the United States of America was a vision for the whole damn world of getting rid of colonial domination. There were hundreds of years, 200 years, in fact, of wars of revolutionary national liberation inspired by the U.S. We got rid of the Queen. Now, to give credibility to the leaders of the government that evolved here as carrying out that tradition of freedom, I think is just inaccurate.
Well, this is an excellent point that Mike makes, which I think what you're saying, Mike, is that there's often a departure from what appear to be the founding ideals and the actual behavior of the United States. And actually, my book is about just that. Nation building has not been some idealistic enterprise, and we've often departed from what should be the values and ideals that underpin it. That's part of the lesson, I hope, that comes from this history, which is that good intentions don't always produce good results, and we need to be more attentive attentive to that. I think in some cases we have managed to adjust and actually do a relatively decent job, which would be to say in places like the American South after the Civil War, in Germany and Japan after World War II. It's not perfect. We still fail more than we succeed, but good things are done. But we get into a lot of trouble, and I think this is probably where Mike is going with his excellent point. We get into a lot of trouble when we go in somewhere and say, well, we're Americans, we're good, and because we're good and we're Americans, we can do whatever we want, and it's going to turn out right. And that's the attitude that a lot of people had in Vietnam, a lot of decision makers. It's the attitude I think many people in the Bush administration had in Iraq, and that's bad nation building. That's nation building that departs from the vision that should underpin our policies.
So I mean, how do you see nation building and America's involvement overseas in a positive aim? What's your analysis of what, why we should be involved in it, mm-hmm. and where it works?
Yeah, I think we need to be very careful about thinking through the places where we really think we want to be involved, where we're committed, and where we can do good. And there are those places. So I think Libya, and I'm not arguing for us to go in all alone in Libya. I'm not arguing for us to do in Iraq and Libya. But I don't see a good argument for saying we should just ignore Libya and say it doesn't matter. We're at a point now where the changes in Libya are having a huge effect upon that region. And we have a strong interest, for good reasons, in a stable, somewhat representative government there. We cannot make that happen, but we cannot pull out of that process. And I'd like us to think about our history, avoid the mistakes we made in Vietnam and Iraq and Libya, and do some of the good things we did in other places in Libya.
What happens, and I know you're a student of I guess, for want of a better term, the School of Realpolitik.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You've written about Kissinger,
mm-hmm.
and
sure.
have some admiration for Kissinger and some questions about him
sure.
as well.
Admiration and criticism.
And both. So I probably have more criticisms than admiration, but that's okay.
I'm not surprised, Mark.
So when you look at, you said Libya, and then we'll go to our next caller. When you look at Libya, I mean, you look at Libya, our policy towards Libya, as compared to our policy towards Egypt,
yes.
as compared to our policy towards Syria, as compared to our policy towards Yemen or Bahrain. I think I have the map right there.
Mm-hmm.
That is a policy that clearly is a realpolitik in terms of what we perceive to be, this government perceives to be its self-interest. But in the long run, it's a policy that will have a lot of blowback in America because it's uneven. It's got no moral ground to it.
Okay, I think
some people would argue.
Yeah, I think you're right. There is inconsistency, and some of that is inconsistency of our government not knowing what it wants to do, being uncertain. And you know this as well as I do. You have different factions in the government that push
right.
for different things, the NSC, the State Department, the Pentagon. And at certain moments, for reasons that often have nothing to do with policy, one group has more influence than another. But I also think that the world of international politics is an uneven place. And
as is everything.
And consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds sometimes. So we need to know what we're about. We need to have a higher purpose, but we need to be willing to adjust that to different circumstances. I don't think we should have the same policy in Libya as we have in Syria.
Well, let me come back to that, but let me ask
Please.
A question here to our listeners come in. 410-319-8888. Michael in St. Mary's County, you're on the air.
Gentlemen, how are you this evening?
Well, welcome.
Really quickly.
Sure, take your time.
The gentleman who called earlier, Mike, I had intended to call in and pretty much make the point he did. I'm glad that he did, and I've heard everything you gentlemen have said this evening. I just want to point out that I'm 58 years old. I'll be 59 in January. I'm perceived as African-American. I'm just a people person, but I'm just painting a picture of who I am.
Mm-hmm, sure.
The point is, I didn't learn any of these things in school, nothing even close. And I'm the class of Duval High School class of 71. What I learned in history about these issues that you're discussing, I learned from my uncle, who was in World War II, other elders I knew in the neighborhood. I grew up in Glen Arden, Maryland, in Landover, in Prince George's County outside of D.C. But I just called to make that point that I was bored in school, and I felt like I was in a bad deal because I knew some things that my instructor, my history teacher, for example, in high school, would ask me, well, Michael, how do you know this? I'm like, excuse me, how do you not even know enough to have this dialogue? What is this? So I just said that to say I was very, very disappointed, and I guess because I'm a kind of a free spirit, former hippie-type guy, I didn't get angry, but I was terribly disappointed that I was so bored in school. How dare you call yourself my professor, and you don't even know this stuff that my uncle's telling me? So I just want to point that out that I don't know what they're doing in school now, but I would hope that we're getting this deep, because this is so exciting. Who wouldn't like history when you go this far?
Michael, you are preaching to the choir. I hope you call in on every radio show I ever do in my lifetime. I couldn't agree with you more. I went to a high school in New York City, a public high school, actually a magnet school, Stuyvesant.
Probably you often listen. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
I had one of the worst teachers I had was one of my history teachers. The guy actually fell asleep. He was so boring himself while he was teaching us. So it's amazing. People always thought I became a historian because I had great history teachers. No. I think Michael hit the nail on the head. History is all around us. Contemporary politics is about history. History is the laboratory for human experience. We need not only to have better history teachers, we need that, and we need more attention to those issues. We also need more of a historical discourse in our society. We need shows like yours, Mark, to have more historical discussion. That's the only way we'll become a better society. And I am frankly fed up with our presidential debates because they're ahistorical. People don't want to deal with the real issues we're struggling with, which are issues like what we're discussing.
So when you look at that and you look at history, and let's just take the Middle East for a moment at the time you've written about Kissinger and his work in the Middle East, and we look at what's going on in the Middle East now, and we do it without a historical context.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a book I just finished reading, it was 1913, about the history of Jerusalem in that 1 year, and how that was the year that kind of began to change everything between natural-born Arab-Palestinians and the Jewish immigrants coming into that area. But if you don't read that, you have no sense of where, if you don't understand that history, you have no sense of where we're going.
Right.
So put that in the context of what I asked you a moment ago.
Right.
You look at some of the reasons we're quiet about the slaughter in Bahrain is because we need Bahrain as a strategically as a place where we have one of the largest bases we have in the Middle East. We're quiet about Yemen because we're sure which way to go and we're afraid to lose it because of its strategic location. Right. We're quiet about Syria because we're terrified what's going to happen to Israel if we go against what's happening in Syria, seeing what's happening in other countries. So we do this, but that is a politics, some would argue, that is a politics of sure destruction, not understanding history, nor our relation to where the future may take us.
Right. So it depends how one does that. This is a great point, Mark. Yes, it's ahistorical, and you get yourself into trouble if you assume because the leaders of Bahrain are our friends, we have to do everything to defend them, and we have some special bond to them, because that's nonsense. They're friends of ours because we serve their interests now, and they serve our interests now. But a historical sensibility would say, let's look at this region, let's look at how complicated this area is. We're never in one fell swoop going to be able to change this. So let's hedge our bets, and let's also prioritize. And I would say, we should hedge our bets. We should make sure we're working with as many people as possible, and we should not get too close to any one regime. But we still have to favor certain regimes that serve our interests, and we have to decide where we're willing to take our risks. What are the places we care about most? And right now, Libya and Egypt are higher on my list than Bahrain. But I want to be careful not to put all my eggs in the basket of the leadership in Bahrain. Pakistan is actually, I think, maybe the best way to think about this. We have invested too much in the government of Pakistan, which is basically shooting at our own forces and wasting our money. We need to work with Pakistan, but we need to liberate ourselves. A historical sensibility would say it's not the government that matters in Pakistan. It's the various different tribal groups, the various different religious groups, and we need to have connections to them.
Well, I mean, that's a complex situation in itself. I mean, as someone said to me, who was involved with the Afghan government, is that from the very beginning of this war in Afghanistan, that Pakistan, he said, was the problem, will be the problem, and will always be the problem, because from the beginning, when the world split the Pathan people in two, or the British did, that's the crux of the problem. Afghanistan has never really been a nation. It's been a place of Pashtuns and everyone else.
Right. But where we have been ahistorical, coming to your point, is we've invested far too much, I think, in a government that is not investing in its own people. And we have not done enough to encourage that government to invest in its own people. That in the short run served our interests. In the long run, it's created a terrible problem. The government has no legitimacy. The military runs the society as a dictatorship and uses the insurgency against us. We are part of the problem there because we didn't think about the historical development of that country. We thought only about our needs at a particular moment.
Well, we're still dealing with some places in the modern world whose countries only existed out of the creation, were 20th century creations.
Yeah.
Out of World War I and colonialism were 20th century creations. They weren't real nations. They never were nations. Pakistan didn't exist anywhere on the planet before 1948. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, India has more of an argument that it existed than Pakistan could ever have.
Right. Yes. But nations are always created that way. I mean, there's an arbitrariness to history and there's an arbitrariness to the moment. The question is what you do after that. You often can't rewrite the past, but you can build on the past in productive ways. And we have not been productively building on that past in many of these societies.
So let me go to the phones here. We have try to get one more caller in here. This is a night from Michael's. 410-319-8888. Michael in Northwest, you're on the air. We don't have much time, Michael, so go ahead.
Yes, Mark, I was really nonplussed when I heard you give assent to the notion that somebody could be both a Hindu and Jewish. You must know that there couldn't be anything more opposite each other than those two religions. On the one hand,
we're not going there right now, Michael. So that's not the crux of the conversation.
Well, grasp of history, and you're talking about other cultures, and even Afghanistan and Pakistan. And when it comes to the most basic belief that a Jew is supposed to have, that there are no other gods but the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you're totally oblivious
Michael, I appreciate the call, but we're not going to enter into it. Jewish theological discussion about who is really a Jew and who is not. My definition of who is really a Jew is they came to get you. Are you Jewish? And the answer is yes, then you're a Jew.
That's exactly, that's exactly what my grandmother said, Mark. She said, see this number on my arm? I'm a Jew.
Right, exactly. So to go back to to where we are, I apologize, sorry. In the last three or four minutes we have. So tell us briefly what you said at the University of Baltimore, in terms of what you think America is.
Well, I mean, they have a fantastic program at the University of Baltimore. I was privileged enough to come in to speak to wonderful students and faculty, and they are thinking through how American society has changed since 9/11. And so I talked about how our traditions, experiences, and missteps in nation building in the past affected the ways in which we reacted to the 9/11 terrorist attacks and the missteps we made as a consequence of not understanding our own history.
So and so, how do you see that playing itself out? As you look at, do you see anybody aware of that whether we disagree, you and I would disagree or disagree on certain specific issues? Do you see anybody aware of that in the political conversation today?
In the foreign policy area, I do think there's actually been some learning over the last, I'd say, 5 to 6 years. It took too long. But I think you could see from 2007 to 2008 a recalibration of American foreign policy. First of all, a recognition of the limits of our power, a recognition that we have to work with other societies, partners. These are the sort of 5 P's I talk about at the end of the book. More partners, recognizing that we have to be better at problem solving rather than pontificating, understanding that we have to have a purpose that people feel invested in, and remembering the people on the ground. We lost sight of that terribly in 2002, 2003. We're still far from where we should be, but I think we've learned lessons the hard way. That my optimistic side as a historian is to say that crisis does produce learning, and we're living through a crisis of our own making, and we learn from that.
We are living through a crisis of our own making. I mean, I think Iraq and Afghanistan in some ways are both of our own making. We were attacked in 2011, but the war that has ensued in Afghanistan is not the one that even in some ways remotely relates to where we are now.
Right, and we had opportunities in Afghanistan to do it differently, or so I argue in my book. Where I fully agree with you is Iraq. Iraq took us well off the tracks. I think we could have done a better job. We could have had a more positive nation-building experience in Afghanistan, but we didn't give ourselves a chance, and we didn't allow ourselves to learn any lessons from the early period we were there.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you, Dr. Jeremy Suri, for joining us.
My pleasure, Mark.
Good to have you here. Last minute, but some of the best conversations happened in the last minute, so it's a pleasure to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
He's professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. His latest book is Liberty's Surest Guardian, American Nation Building from Founders to Obama. You can find the links to his website and his work and books on our website, steinershow.org. It's good to have you here, Jeremy. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Mark.
We'll remind you as we take this break that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. And remember, it is a credit union. It belongs to you. It's not just a bank. And we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Jahan Hafiz, who is a very brave and brilliant journalist reporting out of Cairo with some really interesting stories about what's happening in the streets and the politics of Egypt. Stay with us. We'll be right back.